NPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. As New Hampshire's largest city, Manchester has received far more refugees over the years than smaller communities like Concord or Laconia. But when Queen City Mayor Ted Gatsis recently learned that 600 more refugees were scheduled for resettlement over the next 2 years, he said, enough. Gatsis called for a temporary moratorium on new arrivals, saying the city was already struggling to support the current refugee population, from educating their kids to meeting their health needs to finding housing. Gatsis said adding more refugees would compound those problems and that Manchester needed some breathing room. But refugee resettlement is not within the city's control. It's a U.S. State Department program carried out in Manchester largely by the nonprofit International Institute of New Hampshire. The Institute and other groups believe the city does have the capacity to absorb more refugees and that their contributions to Manchester's economy and culture should not be overlooked. Today in The Exchange, the controversy over refugee resettlement. This program is the first in a year-long project called New Hampshire's Immigration Story. Throughout the coming year, The Exchange and NHPR's editorial team will present coverage highlighting the unique and often untold stories of the state's immigrant and refugee communities from past to present with an eye to the future. Let's hear from you two this hour. Has your community received many refugees in recent years? What impact do you think they have had? And what do you make of Manchester's request for a moratorium? Also, who should be responsible for the care of newly arrived refugees? Is it the federal government, the state, or the city? What about community groups like churches and nonprofits? Give us a call, the exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We have three guests in studio. With us is Suraj Bhutatodgi. He's a Bhutanese refugee, resident of Manchester. He arrived in this country in 2009. He works today with the local refugee community. And Suraj, it's really nice to meet you. I appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much.
Also with us, Bill Gillett. He is, for full disclosure, on the board here at NHPR. He's chairman of the board of the International Institute of New England, which helps resettle refugees in Manchester, Boston, and Lowell. And Bill, good to see you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Laura.
Also with us, Pat Long, Ward 3 Alderman of Manchester and chair of the city's task force on immigrants and refugees. And Pat, welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
And Pat, I want to start with you. Why a moratorium?
Well, after 18 months of studying this, I'm a construction worker, so I didn't have a clue when I first started. As an alderman and a state rep, I got several calls on a daily basis of new arrivals not being looking for food, housing problems, educational problems, adult mostly. So on July 5th, after we submitted a report on July 5th, just to let you know, the committee itself was split on this moratorium for several different reasons. On July 5th, the Board of Mayor and Aldermen voted to support a moratorium after the report was given by a vote of 9-4. And the 4 was there was an amendment added with respect to family reunifications, and that was at odds with us. So with those reasons, to simplify it, I believe the bathtub is full and overflowing. The faucet is running. This moratorium will shut the faucet. Those opposing, in my opinion, this moratorium are just calling for, let's get more buckets to take care of this flood.
So give us an example of how that flood feels. Is it the schools? Is it the health department? Is it housing? What is it, Pat? What specifically is full, in your opinion?
Well, it's not specific. The fullness isn't the resources of Manchester, although that's at issue. The fullness is that there are new arrivals that don't have the opportunity to thrive. My concern is not with those new arrivals that are self-sufficient, that are able to get their own jobs, that have education in their backgrounds from their countries. My concern is those that are falling through the cracks. And I feel that there are plenty of those. And in my opinion, I don't believe one new arrival should have to go to the soup kitchen or walk the streets. I believe Manchester, collaboratively with all these nonprofits and with the Institute, could certainly come up with a plan that'll address all our concerns.
Okay, and we'll definitely get into more detail on that this hour. Bill Gillett, you wrote a passionate letter about this issue saying, quote, any lack of adequate resources in Manchester is a failure of will, not a failure of ability. What are you saying there, Bill?
Well, Laura, we have in Manchester a number of groups that work with refugees and immigrants. They are very willing to support the new arrivals. And this is a long-standing program in Manchester. So we have been bringing new Americans through the refugee program into the city since 1985. It's been a very moderated program. People come here as refugees. They are not anticipating nor are they expecting to come into a perfect situation. And what we're trying to do is give them opportunity. We're trying to give them hope in their lives because, by definition, where the refugees are coming from, there is no hope.
Yeah, when they're fleeing war and persecution, basically.
They are, yes. When they come here, their children are going to get educated. They have economic opportunity. It takes time. It absolutely takes time when the new arrivals come. They come from all kinds of different circumstances. Some of them have some means. Many of them don't, and most of them don't. And so we have to start at some point with bringing those people and the new arrivals into the U.S. and into the economic system and allow them to get started. And at this point, the communities that are coming in now have been fairly successful. We're not seeing significant issues with them.
Can you be more specific,
sure.
Bill?
Well, let me talk about the two groups that we have had coming into Manchester in the last couple of years, and based on what the State Department's told us will be the people coming for the next few years, which are basically the Bhutanese and Iraqi communities. The Bhutanese community has done a great job of starting down that path of assimilation and integration. They have their own community organization. They've gone out and found grant money to support that. They have... and that organization, along with the support that they've gotten from the International Institute and a number of other groups in the city, they work on employment, they work on transportation, they work on health, they work on housing. And they're doing it not by simply looking at us and saying, you know, help us, but doing a lot of it themselves now. And that's been in a span of 2 years. Most of the refugees that will be coming to Manchester, according to the State Department, will be family reunification. And that's primarily more Bhutanese. So they're coming into a support community.
Can you address briefly Pat's concern that, current refugees are not being adequately served? And as he said, the bathtub is full.
Well, I would dispute that current refugees are not being served. And I thought, I will say, I thought the report, the City Task Force report, was an excellent report and a very thorough and a good look at what's happening and, you know, what the situation is. We've had issues from time to time over the years with health issues related to refugees. 7-8 years ago, it was a concern about lead poisoning in some of the housing.
I remember that.
Right. There are concerns about bed bugs right now. But these concerns aren't refugee-specific concerns. These are issues related to life in America. They're issues related to poverty and people in a circle of poverty. The refugees don't bring those with them, basically.
Well, and I want to get you into this too, Suraj. I mean, we're talking about issues that you feel very deeply. And first off, just can you tell us your own story a little bit, Suraj, please? When did you arrive from Bhutan and how come?
I born in Bhutan. And at the age of 10, I became the victim of ethnic cleansing. Then I stayed around 18 years in refugee camp. So we were in impasse. There was no way out to, you know, for resettlement and for repatriation also. So at the end of 2007, America came out saying that, okay, we're going to resettle around 60,000 Bhutanese in America. So that led us the way out. So, and it was not my intention or my wish to come to U.S. It was, you know, the IOM decided me to send here. And I was in Georgia. So it was not my intention to go to Georgia.
They sent you to the state of Georgia, not the nation of Georgia.
State of Georgia.
Right.
And because of some reason, I moved to New Hampshire, Manchester. And I'm happy here in Manchester. I love the place. I love the people. They're all, you know, welcoming, all helpful.
Well, and a couple more questions. And pardon my lack of knowledge, but what was the ethnic cleansing that you mentioned in Bhutan? And we should say Bhutan is in Southeast Asia near India and China, correct?
Yeah, it's in between Tibet and India.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What was the ethnic cleansing?
It's like there are quite four or five ethnic people living in Bhutan. As I can say, Bhutan is also a land of immigrants like America.
Really?
So all the ethnic group, they, you know, different point of time, they came from Tibet, from Nepal, from India, and other part of neighboring countries. And maybe the Nepali-speaking Bhutanese, they live in the southern belt of Bhutan, which is border to India. Mm-hmm. And the Nepali-speaking Bhutanese were influenced by Indian politics, and the Bhutanese, Nepali-speaking Bhutanese were educated and influenced by Indian politics. And maybe Bhutan government, royal government of Bhutan, became paranoid that we're going to, the southern belt, Bhutanese is going to topple their government and, seize their government and can rule. So because of that, they, kicked off Nepali-speaking Bhutanese from southern belt.
Wow. Mm-hmm. You said something else, Suraj, that I think is real important for our discussion here today. You said you didn't want to come to the U.S. Mm-hmm. It's the United Nations that basically says, okay, Suraj, you're in the U.S. now.
Yeah.
What's that like for you?
It was like, climbing in the cliff and see nothing, down to earth. It's just like, wake up in the middle of the night and see nothing in a dark place.
Where did you want to go?
I didn't, think anything about that. It was, America came up with saying that, okay, we're going to take 60,000 Bhutanese. So, okay, the IOM started, screening, looking their education, their biodata, their work history, and I gave my everything, biodata. And IOM decided that, okay, this boy, this Suraj can, make their life in America. Mm. Okay, they decided, and I'm here.
And someone, it's amazing, someone made that decision for you. Real quickly, just so we can get a full picture of your story, Suraj, you were first sent to the state of Georgia. You came to Manchester a little less than a year later. How come?
It's like, I was in Atlanta. It's a big city. And I tried to find out the better place to be in. And, Googling, finding out the places where my qualification, my work experience can, tally. So I found Manchester is a good place for me to be in. So
here you are.
I moved to
All right. Well, all three of you, lots to talk about after a short break. And we will start taking your calls. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here.
Good morning. It's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Tully Automotive Group, Daniel Webster Highway in Nashua, BMW, Buick, GMC, Mazda, and Volkswagen. 53 years of satisfaction in motion, online at Tully.com. And from Keene State College, wisdom to make a difference, preparing students to think critically and creatively, engage in active citizenship, and pursue meaningful work. Information at Keene.edu. More on the upset over refugee resettlement in New Hampshire on The Exchange on NHPR and at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, The Wealth Gap in America. New Hampshire weather today, partly to mostly sunny. It'll start to cloud up from western portions of the state, moving eastward later this afternoon. Highs from low 80s from the White Mountains north, low to mid 80s in the Lakes region and Connecticut River Valley, and mid 80s in southern New Hampshire. A bit cooler along the seacoast. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today we're talking about refugees in Manchester and the Queen City's recent call for a moratorium on new arrivals. We invite you to join us. Call in 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. In your opinion, who should be responsible for helping recently arrived refugees? Is it the state or city government? What about the federal government? What role should community groups like churches and nonprofits play? 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. We go now to Larry Bartlett. He's with the U.S. State Department in its Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration. And Larry Bartlett, we know you're a busy guy. Thank you for making the time for us this morning.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to join this conversation.
What do you make, Mr. Bartlett, of Manchester calling for this moratorium, with the city saying, yes, we appreciate the contributions of refugees, but we need more time to help out those refugees we already have?
I think it's an important point that I think the mayor and other people in the community are making, and I think what it underscores is really the need for dialogue with the community. I mean, one of the, I guess, focus of our program is to really make sure that all stakeholders who are involved in the resettlement process have a say. It's not necessarily, I think, a mandate that any one party should impose over another, but it is important that we have the community voice heard. And so, you know, we've heard the mayor's call. You know, I think it's important. We need to take that into consideration as we go forward. But having said that, we also think that it's important that Manchester would consider to welcome refugees. So we look forward to engaging with the mayor on this issue.
How do you make those decisions that, you know, a certain number of refugees is reasonable for a particular city, while another number might be too much? I mean, are you looking at housing, public transit, jobs? What sorts of criteria are you using there?
All of those things and more. What we do is we have a very rigorous process with our national resettlement partners on an annual basis. We're just having that now for the upcoming fiscal year, which begins in October. And so the national agencies that then have their network of about 350 local affiliates, which are in communities like Manchester, make a proposal to us. That part of the proposal process is that they actually consult with the community, and they do that with both the local level as well as the state level to see, I think, what the community resources might be able to handle. And so we'll be reviewing those proposals shortly, probably in the month of August. We have a team of experts who look at that, who also include people from state governments around the U.S., and then we will make a determination.
How often do you get requests like this from cities to please hold off on refugee settlement for, you know, a given period of time?
It happens from time to time. I would say it's not often. It's certainly maybe one or two requests a year. Usually what happens is that we would be invited to come out to the community to have discussions. And at that point, we would try to work out something, I think, where everybody can be accommodated.
How much federal money, Mr. Bartlett, do refugees get when they first come here? There's often a criticism that, you know, the federal government brings them here and then kind of, you know, dumps them at the corner after 6 or 8 months.
Sure. We're actually pleased that we do, you know, we provide support. I think I would be the first one to tell you it's not enough. It's a part of a whole web, I think, of support that needs to be put together. But we provide $1,800 per refugee. It's not money that's just handed to the refugee to do with what they like, but it's money that actually goes to direct costs that will anchor the refugee during the initial period of resettlement. So that would go towards paying the rent for housing. It would go, there's some walk-around money, there is some for initial food, and then this helps while they can actually be anchored into federal and state systems to which they're allowed to benefit.
Wow, $1,800 doesn't sound like a lot for someone who's got no home, no food, no language skills.
You're right, it's not. And what it is it's not a welfare program. It's not a program that's meant to basically cover refugees for an extended period of time. Other countries in the world have such programs. Sweden, for example, will pay the cost for 2 years. It's not what the Congress intends, and it's actually not what the administration intends in terms of resettlement. The program is really built on the concept of early self-sufficiency. And so what it's meant to do is get people started, but we are promoting that people find employment. And in some cases, that's difficult, especially now in this economy. It's also difficult when we have highly skilled refugees, people who've been engineers and doctors in some cases, looking to work in their field. And what we counsel, and certainly what our local agencies counsel, is that people take the opportunity to find any job, use that job as a springboard, use that job as a way to hone their English language skills, and then move up.
You know, I know you're operating within the confines of the law and what Congress has set out for you in the State Department, but I do wonder, you know, if you could make this program better, what's one or two things that you would do? If it was just up to you, you know, no constraints put on by Congress or the administration.
Sure. Probably a question I can't answer as a member of the administration. But having said that, it's a broad program that has many components. It has overseas components in terms of what refugees we seek to resettle. And I think the point, I want to just make a couple points if I could for that question. One is, you know, we really do seek refugees who are vulnerable. This isn't a program where we seek the most employable. We seek the people who are the most vulnerable. And this is really grounded in our national values. And it's something that Congress has firmly supported throughout the years, and that is that we are helping others. And so as part of our immigration program, our legal immigration program, that's one of the core issues. So having said that, and perhaps moving into your question, you know, that poses obviously significant challenges for resettlement communities around the U.S. And so, you know, one of the things we've looked at is increasing English language training overseas before people arrive, so they're better able to integrate into communities and find jobs.
Right. Like Suraj told us, he was in a refugee camp for 18 years, so a good part of that time spent learning English would be time well spent.
Absolutely. But the other issue, I think, and I think it was your previous caller, and I'm not sure if that was Suraj, had mentioned that he had moved from Atlanta to New Hampshire. And so part of our goal also, and I think this plays back, and I think to the mayor's call for a moratorium, is, you know, refugees, when they arrive in the U.S., become legal permanent residents, and they have the ability to move around the country. And so one of our challenges and one of the things that we work with a lot is trying to figure out where to place a refugee, where they can stay. You know, where is the community going to be welcoming? Where will the jobs be? Where will their family members be? Because often refugees will move within the U.S. to find a better situation. So if we can make a good initial placement, you know, we'll prevent that secondary movement, which is also, frankly, a larger burden on the community. And if I may make one more point, the program in Manchester, and actually the program in Concord is the same, is limited to placing refugees who already have ties in the community. And so, you know, one of the issues that we would want to discuss with the mayor and others is, you know, we don't want to have an entire moratorium on a place like Manchester and then have hundreds of refugees flood in after the fact without any federal government support.
I see what you're saying. You know, Larry, thank you very much. This has been real interesting.
Okay, you're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Larry Bartlett. He's with the U.S. State Department in its Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration. Our number for you to join us here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Bill Gillett, Pat Long, Suraj Buddhatoki, lots to talk about. Just quickly to you, I think, Pat Long, the money piece. Mayor Gatsas has said that there isn't enough money following refugees when they come to Manchester. Mr. Bartlett said, well, there's $1,800. What's your perception of how much federal support Manchester gets for refugees?
Well, speaking with the Catholic Charities, they were also a volunteer agency, which they call a VOLAG, which the Institute is, and LSS is also.
LSS is Lutheran Social Services,
Lutheran,
right?
Lutheran Social, okay. Services, right. And the Catholic Charities drew back because they don't believe there's enough money to help the new arrivals in their goal of being self-sufficient. So, once again, with Manchester, it's not necessarily the money. It's necessarily what is self-sufficiency. Early self-sufficiency, as Larry mentioned. What's included in self-sufficiency? Is it public subsidized? If you're receiving public subsidized housing or TANF or what have you, is that considered self-sufficient? And I believe it is. And that's where the problem exists. I know Bill had mentioned the, you know, Bhutanese and the Iraqis are the ones that are going to be coming in. And they're more apt to be self-sufficient. I could agree with that.
May need less support than some of the earlier African refugees.
Correct. But Manchester has a look at the last 4 to 5 years, you know, the thousands of refugees that have been here, because in a listening session with the mayor, we've had over 120 new arrivals come in. You know, they're all one to 5 years in Manchester, and there were still issues. So we need to, you know, our concern is those coming in, and also after the 8 months, who handles them after the 8 months? How are they helped to you know, give an opportunity after the 8 months?
You know, and I have to ask you this, Pat, and then we'll go to our callers. Some people have accused you of coming at this issue out of xenophobia. You know, you and others don't like new people. You have said very emphatically, no, that is not the case. You're coming out of a place of deep concern. And there was a story that you tell about a little boy who really just, you know, ripped your heart out. And that's where you're coming from in terms of supporting this moratorium.
Yeah, it started about 3 years ago with this bedbug-infested refugee resettlement apartment building where I got some iron workers, and we helped move some furniture. We had to get rid of all the furniture, put new furniture in there, and clean the apartments. I was there every day. You'd lift up a piece of furniture, and it'd be crawling all over you with everything.
Yeah.
I went into a 9-year-old boy's room. There was a mural of blood lines from him staying up all night killing the bed bugs. I mean, it wasn't a 20 or 30. It was 100 or 200 of them. The fact that people may think that I have an issue with new arrivals, I may be racial or, you know, whatever. I've done plenty, and I continue. I personally love Manchester having this cultural differences. I enjoy that.
All right. Well, I know you both probably have some things to say, but I want to get our callers into our conversation, too. So our number, 1-800-892-6477. Emails are welcome, exchange@nhpr.org. First up is Bill and Wes Deering. And, Bill, hey, thanks for hanging on. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange.
Well, hi. Thank you, Laura. I had the misfortune of having to move into a room and house in Concord last winter, and it had three African gentlemen. One was from Sudan, one was from Cameroon, and one was from Rwanda. And it was, to me, it was kind of sad to bring these guys over here, and they were all good guys, fun to be with, but they couldn't get a good job. One had worked at Walmart, one working as a janitor. The Walmart one was like a $6 an hour job. And all three of them had illegitimate children here. I shouldn't say that word. Children by another person in New Hampshire. But
so you felt bad for these gentlemen, Bill. They didn't get much help. They were working incredibly low wage jobs. That's what you're saying?
Exactly. And English was a big problem. One sure. was trying to go into the tech up in Laconia, and he had a tutor. But I think she was only there about once every week, or maybe even not that. And I was trying to help him with his tests. And not having a good grasp of English, I don't think, helped him a bit.
Well, you know, let me ask you a quick question, and I really appreciate your call. In one sense, I hear you. You know, it's tough. They don't speak English. They're working incredibly low-wage jobs. In a way, though, some would say that's the American story. People come, they scrape. Their kids have a better life, and, you know, eventually they grow up to be, you know, mayors and politicians and business people and so on. I just wonder what you think about that.
It's true. I'm supposedly, my genealogy, my predecessors came here with a grasp of English. They came from Scotland and Ireland. And so that wasn't the problem, was it? I think, you know, if these guys, if they would work harder at tutoring them, teach them English, really work with them on learning English, because that's a necessity.
All right. Bill, I think I get your point, and I'm really glad you called. And I think to you first, Suraj, lots of points that Bill brings up. First off, the idea that you know, when refugees arrive, there isn't a lot of help, especially with the English. It's hard to get a job. What are you seeing? You work with refugees in Manchester. What are you seeing as some of the challenges and maybe success stories that they face when they try to get off their feet?
Challenges are first, as Pat told before, the housing challenges and the ESL, English is the first, you know, foremost challenges. However, if anybody has, you know, dedication, and if anybody has, you know, some kind of power, willpower, that they're gonna be prosper in the future in America, they will definitely, you know, strive their future. Yeah.
What are you hearing from refugees about the challenges of learning English? Obviously, that's huge. And by the way, your English is great, considering you've only been here not long. Is there enough tutoring? Are most people getting English as a second language, or is there some difficulty getting that as well?
Yes, they're having difficulty getting that because some ESL classes they, you know, run in the evening time. They may have to go for the, you know, evening job, part-time job, and And some ESL classes are, you know, run in the morning time, and because of timetable also, they are not getting, you know, ample, they're not spending ample time for learning English also. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for that call, Bill. And let's go to Carolyn in Manchester. Hey, Carolyn, thanks for calling in. Thanks for hanging on. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
I had a comment when he was saying that the refugees have $1,800 to help them out with food and rent and so on. I myself am disabled. I have two children that I support. I get $1,700 a month, the three of us. There's a lot of issues in Manchester with people that are seeing this influx of immigrants, which I have friends that are immigrants. They're wonderful people. And I think we should support them more and not have more come in and still support the citizens of Manchester that are out of work, that are unemployed, that are really not getting the help.
So, Carolyn, So you're saying people already in Manchester are having trouble, so let's focus on them first.
Right. Right now I have my girlfriend just came over, and I'm going to she worked 20 years in the hospital, and she got laid off, and she's tried to get a job, but she's overqualified.
Mm.
And so she went for help, and they couldn't help her. Now, they gave her food stamps, but they couldn't help her with paying the rent or anything like that. And I see this very frequently in this area.
You know,
and it's sad, very sad. You know, we have to build up Manchester and support the people that are already in here.
Once you know, Carol, this is a good point. I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're heading into a break. And I did want to get you in on this, Bill Gillett. You know, things are tough for people who are already here. She's right. You know, jobs are scarce, and it's tough times for everybody. What do you think? Take care of the people who are already here first before more come in.
Sure. This really is, Laura, as you pointed out earlier, this is part of the American story, the American experience. And with the refugees and with immigration into this country, what we're really doing is making an investment. Times are tough, absolutely. They are tough everywhere. You know, I will point out that Manchester's unemployment rate is actually significantly lower than the rest of the nation, the national average. But that doesn't mean it's not tough here. At this point, what we're trying to do is bring people in and get them started. And those, the investment that we make now, if you look at the communities that came 20 years ago, the Vietnamese communities, 10 years ago, the Bosniak communities, they are now very supportive and important part of the Manchester community. They're taxpayers, they're business owners, and that's what we're trying to do here.
All right. Well, I'm sorry to cut you off there, Bill. Carolyn, thanks a lot for the call. We'll take more of your calls after a short break, so keep it right here.
I'm Randy Benthien of Benthien Associates. Frankly, one of the reasons that we have done this for 23 years and know we're going to continue supporting NHPR is that so many of the people that make decisions in our business and nonprofit clients also listen to New Hampshire Public Radio. And when they hear us sponsoring different programs, they remember us and they think of us and they contact us.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the attorneys at Orrin Reno, Global Vision, New Hampshire Values, trusted business advisors for entrepreneurs, business owners, and nonprofit corporations, orrin-reno.com. And from the Flying Monkey Performance Center in Plymouth, presenting Natalie McMaster and Donnell Leahy, Masters of the Fiddle, tomorrow at 7:30 p.m. Tickets at flyingmonkeynh.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, refugee resettlement in Manchester and a recent request for a moratorium on new arrivals. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Has your community received refugees in recent years? What impact do you see them having on your city or town? What do you make of Manchester's request for a moratorium? And who should be responsible for the care and for helping newly arrived refugees? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. And gentlemen, I want to share an email with you now, and I think I'll give this to you again, Bill Gillett. This person says, what would the moratorium do to other refugee cities like Concord? Do you have any idea about that? I have seen that question elsewhere.
I don't know the answer to that from the State Department perspective. There's a set number of refugees that the State Department takes into the United States every year, and they determine how the allocation is made from city to city.
And this raises a question that I think, Pat, a lot of people don't understand, that, again, it's really the State Department making these decisions. It's not Manchester or the state of New Hampshire.
That's correct. It's the State Department makes all these decisions. We just recommend.
Well, and here's a Facebook comment from Lisa who says, wouldn't it be nice if the rest of the state stepped in to help? Do they all really need to stay in Manchester? Again, Pat, that's not really up to the rest of the state.
No, that's correct. That's up to the State Department again.
Bill.
Well, let me just make the point that there are, in some ways, much of the state does help because there are a number of private donations and contributions that come in to the various volunteer agencies that help refugees. And there are some statewide programs, of course, that support refugees as well. So there is some state support from refugees, whether they're in Manchester, Concord, or Laconia.
And I wanted to ask you too, Bill, we heard from the State Department earlier, and Larry Bartlett there said, we work with the local agency, in Manchester's case, meaning you guys, the International Institute. As I understand, you make a recommendation to the State Department. You say, we think Manchester can handle 300 this year. And the State Department considers that advice. Is that how it works?
That's basically how it works. Ours is a recommendation. The number that we give may or may not be accepted by the State Department. And the actual number of refugees who arrive, it may or may not be at that number. I mean, this year will be a little bit below this year's target.
So. And one of the critiques that I've heard over the years, Bill, is that International Institute doesn't work enough with the city, the local charities, the local churches to arrive at that number. Is that a fair criticism, or do you pull this number out of the air, or do you work with other people to arrive at that number?
Well, let me take that in two parts first. The criticism that we don't work enough with the city and the other agencies, we would certainly dispute. We think there is a considerable amount of communication between us and the city, particularly with respect to the school board, or the school officials, with respect to the health department. We do work with the other agencies in Manchester. And we really, and I think the task force report pointed this out too, we are looking to continue that and to create a better continuum of services because we, as a gateway agency, really work with the refugees for the first 6-9 months they're here, working on language training, working on job training, making sure the kids are getting into the schools, addressing health concerns. But we do need a longer-term coordination of all of the support services that are out there.
And Suraj, you know, there is a whole group of people and organizations that are helping refugees. How do you help people find their way through that, though? They come. There's the International Institute, but there's also churches, the state, other organizations. Do you help people figure out, okay, you can get some help with housing here, food here? How do you work through that?
This was challenges for us before when when new arrival comes. But later when we form our own organization, nonprofit organization, then we knew from which organization we get what. What resources is there? So now we are capable of, referring our people who are in need of, housing support, pantry, anything else they need support. We are now able to send them where they can get it.
Was it hard getting that together initially, organizing that? Right.
Yeah, it was hard.
Right. Mm-hmm. Because there's so many places to turn to and so many pieces of paper you probably have to fill out.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you're right.
I want to bring now another voice into our conversation. This is Amy Marshalden. She's Director of Services for New Americans at Lutheran Social Services of New Hampshire. Now, this is a group that helps resettle refugees in Concord, Nashua, and Laconia. Amy, thanks for your time this morning. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to join the conversation.
Well, we've been talking about Manchester this hour, but I do wonder, Concord hasn't received as many refugees as Manchester, but per capita, where does Concord stand?
Over the last 3 years, we've resettled about just a little over 500 refugees in Concord, and I believe that's about 0.13% of the population.
Mm, so not a whole lot, but a reasonable number, given that Concord's a city of 40,000 people.
Sure, yes.
And do we hear, Amy, the same sorts of concerns in Concord that we hear coming out of Manchester? Look, we can't do this. Our services are already strained.
We're not hearing those particular concerns from the city officials, city structure. From time to time, we may hear some feedback from local community members about limited resources, and we share people's concern and actually applaud their concern about that. But we always try to help educate people regarding the humanitarian aspect of the U.S. refugee program and try to help people remember that that by virtue of being resettled, people are able to start their lives over again. And sometimes I say that people may struggle to die in a refugee camp, but they can struggle to live in the U.S.
Why do you suppose we're not hearing calls for a moratorium coming out of Concord or Laconia?
Well, I think, I think in our communities where we do resettlement, we have local coalitions that work very hard to help refugees get integrated. And so we have that structure in Concord, Laconia, and Nashua. I think that there's good communication with those groups, and I think that refugees have a strong network of support. We have a lot of volunteers, either through our program or just in the community, who are very interested in helping refugees become integrated.
How many refugees, Amy, are slated to come to Concord in the next year?
We give a total number, and we have just a little over 200 for our program, of which perhaps anywhere from 60 to 100 may come to Concord.
Okay, Amy, thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Amy Marshaldon, Director of Services for New Americans at Lutheran Social Services of New Hampshire. Real quick to you, Pat Long, again, you're a Ward 3 alderman in Manchester. Any lessons learned from Concord's experience versus Manchester's experience, or is it two different balls of wax there?
Yeah, I believe it's two different balls of wax. For example, Laconia, Concord, and Nashua took in 600 in the last roughly 600 in the last 3 years. Manchester took in 1,100. The per capita measurement, I don't agree with. Manchester has its inner city. Concord is a little different dynamic than Manchester is. Mm-hmm. So I don't think the per capita is a fair way of challenging that. I just need to address the dialogue. Larry hit it on the nail on the head, the need for dialogue, the consulting with the community.
Amy talked about that too. She said,
correct,
we have good communication, a good, strong local coalition. You work out these numbers in advance. Go ahead, Pat.
Yeah, Bill had mentioned that they feel that they communicate, the Institute communicates with the health department and the school department. That's federally mandated. They're required by law to do that. The issue is communications with the city. And that's where we seem to have an issue. The 18 months that this committee was going, this task force was going, three or four times the Institute was at the table. They were at the table when discussion of a moratorium came up. When I took that off the table because I didn't want to ruin our work, discussing this, that could have went on forever, we didn't see them anymore. So I don't know what the secret is. I think we need communications, and I think we need the communications to start now. And with respect to the Bosnian community, I had the privilege of working with the Bosnians as a member of the building trades in New Hampshire. We took in 100 Bosnians in the early mid-90s to early 2000s. We had the work. We were able to put them to work. They were construction workers, so it was a no-brainer. My concern, once again, is those that need that extra help to be self-sufficient. And to address Amy, I think through collaborations, Manchester has the room. We need to get our thumb on this. I don't believe, the so-called taking jobs away from, Americans. I don't believe that's the case.
That our earlier caller referenced.
I've met new arrivals that were tickled pink to have minimum wage jobs, and that's their soul. They want to be self-sufficient. They want to work. If it's making 100 a week or 200 a week, they're able to stretch that out. Where I kind of questions how some Americans are able to stretch out to $200 a week. But they're self-sufficient with minimum wage jobs. But the question is, are there enough out there, and are they able to hold on to these jobs?
And super quick, Bill Gillett, again, I want to give you a chance to respond here real briefly. This issue keeps coming up with International Institute, and it's come up over the years, not just this year, but over the, you know, I've done plenty of programs on this in prior years. Again, there's this feeling by the city that you guys aren't talking together and reaching consensus on these numbers.
And I appreciate the concerns over that. I will say we have met with the mayor. I've met with the mayor. Our executive director has met with the mayor. And our new we have a fairly new site director in Manchester who's doing a fabulous job. And just to Pat's point on this, when the task force talked to him and asked him for some information, they did get a very comprehensive response from him that same day. So I think this is a little bit overblown in terms of communication.
Let's take some calls, gentlemen. And Chow is calling from Hooksett. Hi, Chow. Go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm a refugee from Vietnam myself in 1994. And I came here and I worked for the International Institute in New Hampshire since, not until now, but for many years. And I went to Southern University of New Hampshire here. And the issues of not allowing to bring refugees coming to Manchester, New Hampshire, like you said, has been resurfacing like many times over and over again. I remember Ann Sanderson, our like oldest and longest site director, had been fighting with the city over that. And many times she was criticized so many times. And then a few years ago, I was attending an award of her being like the Citizen of the Year by the mayor. So according to Alderman Pat Long, money is not an issue. So it should not be an issue at all of bringing a refugee into Manchester, New Hampshire, because the people that come here, they have a strong living will power, which is the great new energy to put into the city to help it to synergize with other energy that has been here that has been so comfortable because life has been so comfortable for them.
So, Chow, are you saying a moratorium is not the way to go, that refugees provide energy and jobs and small businesses once they get up and running? Is that what you're saying? Do I understand
yeah,
you right?
We have a very strong will of getting all that running, and we need very little help at the beginning, but they all turn out great.
Okay.
And I'm one, and most of us, actually, almost if not all Americans started somewhere as a refugee. So if we should just remember that history, then we shouldn't be, you know, bugging each other of stopping this and stopping that and forget about the human factor of forming this country.
Okay, and Chow, I want to let Pat Long talk about that real quickly. The, you know, there's a big contribution that refugees also make to Manchester that she's saying.
I
agree. So don't cut it off.
No, I agree. I agree with her with respect to, you know, she came in 1994. Times were different in 1994. Like I mentioned with the Bosnians, they became self-sufficient quick. They were able to go to work in construction jobs. My issue right now, well, especially now with federal and state cuts being happening, we were with Siraj at the Commissioner of Welfare in Manchester, Commissioner Martineau. There were families with the family assistance program that was cut. There were 86 Manchester families that didn't have rent or food for August. Some of them were from the Bhutanese community. There were 36 they identified. And there were also some Africans. So those are also concerns. The opportunity in 1994 is completely and clearly different in 2011.
Well, Chow, good to hear from you. And let's take one more. This is Dan in Manchester. Hi, Dan. Go ahead.
Hi. Great topic. My goodness, it's so complex. I work closely with Pat Long and others in the community through St. Anselm College, reaching out to the refugees. And I so agree with Pat in terms of the English language challenge that the refugees face. And it's not rocket science, but here we are in 2011, still not really approaching this English acquisition as a science and throwing all of the resources that we can at it. And there's going to be generations, even if we stop refugees now, generations of struggle if the folks that are here don't learn English. It's harder for adults to learn English than the children. If the adults don't learn English, they can't help their children in schools. It's such a complex thing, but it's not rocket science. We need to throw everything we have at it now And then I think a lot of the problems will be, have a different perspective. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, Dan, thank you so much. This keeps coming up. Larry Bartlett from the State Department brought it up. Pat brought it up. Suraj brought it up. Thanks a lot for calling in. Real quick to you, Bill Gillett, let's throw everything we have, he says, at this English issue. And then other issues will work themselves out, like employment and so forth.
I think that's great. It would be the more resources we can put to this, the better we are. The more people that are involved in helping, the better off we will all be. But I don't think that the system at this point is failing or a complete failure. And I just want to point out, for every story that we hear of real struggle and real challenges, there are also stories equally of great success. I had a discussion with one of the Bhutanese refugees last week who asked me for advice about buying a house because he's gotten to the point now where that's what he wants to do. You know, and that's the kind of success that we see. And we have to address the issues, as Pat has said and the task force has said, but I don't see how stopping the flow of a successful community is going to help us do that.
And you know, Suraj, I haven't asked you this, even though we've been talking about it all hour. What do you think of this moratorium?
I was with the, you know, the Manchester City Task Force on Refugee and Immigrant Integration Subcommittee, Housing Subcommittee. And from there itself, I learned, you know, about refugee and immigrants in the Manchester and their situation. To me, imposing temporary moratorium is not going to solve the problem. Instead, it increases the problem. I can give you a reason. If there is temporary moratorium for 2 years, then it increases the secondary migration.
Right. All right. Which we talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. And Suraj, I'm really sorry I have to cut you off there, but I have the feeling we'll be talking again. So thank you very much for being with us. And Bill Gillett and Pat Long, thank you for being here, too. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. Our series on immigration is made possible in part by the New Hampshire Humanities Council and the Norwin S. and Elizabeth N. Bean Foundation. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Keith Shields is our executive producer. And I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed